Was it easy for you guys to go to Russia?
It actually was extremely difficult with, sort of especially the bureaucratic, getting visas, getting, of course, fundraising, you know, for tickets and all of that. And especially with the complicated political situation right now, I think it was, you know, very difficult, but things came together. Daria did a lot of work to get it through. So we were, really blessed to be able to go over.
Yeah, Tristan's visa came in a day late, and I had to stay back and wait for his visa. We left the next day, so the visa came in, and we were able to travel on our own. A friend of Daria's, Victoria, she just said, follow the group, and it'll take you where you need to go to the next flight. So we followed, like, we knew where we're going.
So these two men have never been farther than Seattle. So when Walter found out that he had to fly to Germany over the North Pole and then from Germany to Moscow, his eyes grew bigger than I've ever seen. Well, but Tristan, who can read Cyrillic, he was not afraid, and he supported his dad, and the two of them joined our group one day later. But what was important is that from both sides, from the Russian side and the American side, everybody was praying for this boy to make it and join the group, because it was so difficult for him to get that visa. Most of our passports were hand-carried by volunteers on the planes to Anchorage, then from Anchorage to Seattle. It was quite a logistical operation, like special op in logistical terms.
Real quick, like, why? So there are volunteers that carry your passports down to Seattle? I guess I'm confused about why wouldn't you guys be carrying your passports?
Well, because there was one person who was helping us, who was also a Russian, who works for a travel agency, and she volunteered just because we were pilgrims. And she flew all of our passports to the Russian consulate in Seattle. And there the consul already knew that we pleaded that there are 16 villagers from Alaska. It's their first time to Russia. Please help and open all this gate. And actually, wherever we went, people understood that this was a very special circumstance for people from the villages who have never been anywhere far. It was, for the most of our group, including Father John, it was their first time getting passports even. So they're not world travelers at all. So for them to cross that many borders and 12 time zones, that was quite an undertaking. And so they flew. The main group flew from Anchorage to Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky. It took 4 hours only on Yakutia Airlines, and then took another plane for 8 hours to Moscow. And on their flight back, they flew over the North Pole on Qantas Airlines. Maybe Tristan can speak about the North Pole.
The North Pole, it didn't look cold from the airplane. There was a lot of water because it was frozen. And the tip of a arrow, the arrowhead, that's when I first looked out. That's what I noticed, because it was shining right into the plane from the sun. And we were flying very low.
What do you mean, the tip of the arrowhead?
Like, they look like spikes.
Mountains?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why did so many people go on this trip? Like, it sounds like it was for a conference, but 16 people went who never have been outside the United States. Like, what brought this group together from all around the Kodiak region to go to St. Herman's hometown?
I think it was a real sense of mission that we were bringing a piece of Alaska and a piece of history, and even St. Herman himself, his presence back to where he had left. And so we were very, very motivated, and also to kind of almost like a homecoming. So when you have that before you, you really, it can be very motivating.
Alutiiq people, Alutiiq Orthodox, perceive themselves as the children of Saint Herman. They grow up as children with this name, Apa Herman or Apanjuk, Grandpa Herman, the one who took care of the orphaned children in Yuzinki. And that's, but people in the small city of Kadom, Kadom, they never knew that Saint Herman was their kin. So it was, as Father John mentioned, it was a historical mission for the children of Saint Herman to tell about the life of Saint Herman, about the life of their kin, like first hand, to bring their and share their love. And that's why when our Alutiiq, and that's why the majority of the group, they were Alutiiq Orthodox from Kodiak and Chugach regions, the people who were first baptized into Orthodoxy by Kodiak missionaries. And St. Herman was part of this mission of that came to Kodiak in 1794. And people who listened to the miracles that St. Herman did in Kodiak, there in Kadom, they were inspired. And I, as a witness and not a Alutiiq myself, to see how the love that was kept through generations was brought back and shared with the people who raised St. Herman, that was, I still cannot wrap my mind about that. That no better novel can be written. As a literature person, I can say about that. That is, it is a spiritual homecoming, a homecoming of St. Herman back to his town in the hearts of his children.
So, Walter and Tristan, I don't mean to assume, but are y'all Alutiiq?
Yes, I am. Proud to be an Alutiiq. As I was growing up, my mother and father, especially my grandma, would tell us to go to church, go to church. If my mom and dad are not home, my sister would tell me to go to church. And one time I didn't go to church, and I felt guilty. You felt like you had to hide because you weren't in that group. So next Sunday, I went to church and I was in that group. You felt that your spirit was wider and you could move freely. That's how it felt.
So I was just wondering, what was it like for y'all as Alutiiq Orthodox or in our people of Alutiiq heritage who are also a part of the Orthodox Church to go to the place of St. Herman and kind of share what he did in the region?
The feeling was you had to see it to get this feeling. When you see it in the church, that's a story. But when you see it for your own eyes where he's from, then you believe that he's a saint now. And it all fills the space that you were wondering about. It's fulfilled. So when you do have that empty spot, okay, I got that filled. Now what's next?
So it kind of made him more real to you in a way? To be
yes,
honest?
Yes, it does. It you can't just say, he's a person. I heard somebody say he's a person, but I felt offended on that because I believe, I pray to him. And then when somebody says he's just a person, that make me feel that I would be praying to anyone. So when I do believe that Saint Herman is a saint, it does fill that empty space you have. So it does make you feel comfortable that you believe.
So in a way, you were able to kind of explain how what Saint Herman means to you, to people from where he's from, and explain why he's so special to you on this trip?
Yes. Me as a fisherman, like I said before, he was my captain. I was the crew, and it was very emotional to see people that just heard about Saint Herman over there. And it was a lot of people that gathered to see his church open. And that was very emotional, and I'd like to see how it is. That's what I feel.
Just adding, I think, a little bit of context, as you probably know, the Russian church was severely persecuted, especially after 1917, so we actually walked through many, you know, destroyed churches that were, you know, that were destroyed because of the ideology of the time. So, bringing, you know, Saint Herman back, that actually was in particular a particular church that was going to be one of the chapels would be dedicated to Saint Herman. So he's kind of part of the restoration that's going on there post-communism, that the church is rising from the ashes, and he's kind of part of that as well.
By bringing St. Herman back, did you actually bring a relic to Russia?
Yeah, we actually brought four relics with blessing of our bishop.
And what were the relics, and where did they actually end up?
So they were given to, you know, to the bishop of the area and several of the churches, there in the region.
And it was Father John who carried, as is the custom, carried on his heart in a special pouch. He carried the relics through all the customs and through the 12 time zones.
I guess for those who aren't of the Orthodox faith or really religious at all, what do you mean by relic, and what is a relic?
So a relic would be, you know, a piece of his body, and we believe in Orthodoxy that sanctification is of soul and body. So for a holy person, that not only are they spiritually made holy in some sense, but that their body also participates in this holiness and this sanctification. So when we have a relic, we have a special relationship with that holy person, and a close kinship, spiritual kinship with them.
So when you say you brought St. Herman back, you're not just talking about the story, you're talking about you actually brought a piece of him back to his home.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think we're talking about both. We brought the stories and the faith, because whoever met our group of Alutiiq villagers, they could all feel the faith that was untarnished and blemished by the horror of the Bolshevik Revolution that destroyed the churches. So miraculously, the faith that was given to the Greeks by the Jews and from the Greeks was passed on to Russians, and then from the Russians was passed on to the native Orthodox. It was brought back to St. Herman's land, and you know, from spiritual perspective, if you put these pieces of the puzzle, this is again an incredible story. And you know, seeing the story myself, I was wondering whether others could feel the same that I felt. But all who met our villagers, they said that they fell in love with them because they could feel the purity of faith.
That was KMXT's Mitch Borden speaking with a group from Kodiak who just returned from a trip to Russia. And you're listening to Talk the Rock. My name is Kayla DeRoche. I'm your host today. And we have with us someone from the Kodiak Maritime Museum, Toby Selvin. Why don't you introduce your museum?
Yeah, hi, Kayla, and thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm Toby Selvin. I'm the executive director of the Kodiak Maritime Museum. And we are engaged in a big project to restore and exhibit a historic fishing boat. And we're well on our way through the project. And my understanding is that what we are going to talk about today.
Yeah. For people who might not be familiar with the Thelma Sea, can you give a background about that vessel?
Yeah. Well, originally the boat was built in 1965. It's a 38-foot commercial marine seiner built in Seattle on Lake Union. And it was built because the owner, who was from a Fognak Island, had a boat that was destroyed in the 1964 tsunami, actually in Valdez. But he needed a new boat, so he went down to Seattle and had a new boat built the next year. And he used a Small Business Administration loan that the federal government had set up because there were all these fishermen that needed new boats that had been destroyed in the tsunami. So the federal government stepped in, had a low-interest loan program, and they built a lot of these boats. And the Thelma Sea was one of, we think, probably 100 of these boats that were built. And it's probably the only one left. There's a couple here and there, but they're not fishing anymore. So this is the last one.
So how did the Maritime Museum get a hold of this particular vessel? Why didn't it go to, for instance, like the Barana or something like that?
Well, the last owner of the boat was going to upgrade and get a newer boat, and he talked to people at the Maritime Museum at least 10 or 12 years ago, and he said, I'll donate the boat to you folks. And the Maritime Museum at the time was looking for a boat to restore and exhibit. What was happening at the time in the late 90s, early 2000s, is a lot of old boats were being literally burned down here on the spit. They were derelict in the harbor, and they had really gone past their fishing days. And so the harbor master was getting stuck with all these old boats, and some of them were being burned. And the Maritime Museum Board of Directors was concerned that a large piece of Kodiak's maritime history was being lost, literally going up in smoke. So they wanted to get a boat that they could restore and exhibit and tell the story of Kodiak's fishing history, especially the salmon seine industry. And that boat fit the bill perfectly because it seined around Kodiak and in Chignik for 30 or 40 years.
And the Maritime Museum itself is actually kind of unique because it doesn't really have a home base right now.
Yeah, that unique is one good word for that. Yeah, we do not have a museum of our own yet. That's someday in the future. We need a lot more money for that. We have to work on our endowment fund, and we still would need to get a place to put it, a piece of land as well. So the museum is a museum of the mind, we like to refer to it, but we have a pretty good website presence. And we do projects around town like the Harbor Lights Festival and this big exhibit. So, and we've done other exhibits over the years. So we do have a presence in the community, just not a physical presence.
What is the origin of the museum? I've always been curious to know.
That is a very interesting question because in the 90s, Kodiak fisheries were changing drastically. IFQs were coming in and the fisheries were changing quite a bit. And so three fishing women from they were set netters from the west side of Kodiak, Sue Jeffrey, Lacey Burns, and Virginia Adams, they got together and they said, you know, we need a museum because the maritime history of Kodiak was not being addressed in other museums in town. And they started with nothing, just their own energy, and they did a lot of work. Their first project was those interpretive signs right across from Sutliff's down on the harbor. That was their first project, and they did that before there was even a board of directors, really. They raised the money, they got it designed, and they put them in 14 signs. And you go down there, they still look great. They've lasted a long time.
How did you get involved with the museum?
Well, they were a board of directors, and it was all volunteers. And as these things go, they started to burn out. They were working really hard, but, you know, it's unpaid, and they were doing it on their desk between all their other things they were doing in their lives. And they had a board of directors by then, but the founders, Lacey and Sue and Virginia, they were getting tired of doing everything. They just ran out of time. So they started looking around for someone who would work as a director. And they had a director for a year or two before me, and then he went on to Greater Glory and some other job. And they asked me if I'd be interested in it. And I said, sure. It kind of lined up with my schedule and my interest as well. So it's worked out really well.
What did you do before the museum?
Well, I've been a commercial fisherman since 1975. And I've worked at the college in the winter and a few other places in the winter for the last few years. And so I was looking for something to do in the winter rather than go to the Bering Sea, and this kind of worked that way really well.
And so now this exhibit, you're kind of forming this exhibit around the Thelma Sea. That is the first exhibit that you've had, the first stationary exhibit?
It's the first outdoor exhibit that we've done, aside from those signs along the harbor. It will be, we actually poured concrete last night for the pad, so it should be up and running and ready for visitors within, we're hoping, by the end of October. But it's down by Trident Seafoods in the parking lot on the spit. And what we'll do is we have a concrete pad and a framework made of steel, structural steel, that the boat will sit in, a cradle. And the boat will sit in that, and then there'll be interpretive signs around it, which will talk about the history of the boat, the tsunami which destroyed Kodiak's downtown in 1964, and it'll talk about the culture of salmon fishing on Kodiak Island.
Okay, and so this whole vessel is going to kind of be grounded and put on the spit, and you can just enter it? What's it going to look like?
Well, the boat will be there, but you won't be able to get on it. The liability issues are too great for that. But you will be able to see it and walk around it. And eventually we'll have some sort of a platform where you can see onto the deck. We're still working on some of the engineering details for that. And then we still need to put a roof over it, and we are in the process of designing a funding plan to get the money to build a roof over it. The idea is that it would be an open structure so you could see the boat. It wouldn't be inside a small building, but there would be a roof over it to keep the rain off.
Okay, so what will the exhibit text or the exhibit information look like?
There'll be interpretive panels, a set of five large interpretive panels, very similar to the ones that are down on Shelikoff Street across from Sutliff's. And those will have the information about the boat and all these other things we're trying to address with the exhibit.
Has this exhibit been long in the making? Have you been planning it for it for a while?
We have been planning it for a number of years, yeah. They got the boat in 2006, I believe, and we rebuilt it with funding from the state legislature in 2012. We restored it and did a whole bunch of work on the planking, had it repainted, so it's ready to be exhibited. And we've been designing the interpretive panels for the last year. And then, of course, the construction part of it has been in the works for a couple of years as well.
What's the timeline attached to the project? When do you think it'll be complete?
We are hoping to have the boat in place this fall, and the interpretive panels soon after that, and the roof within the next year. I think probably my thinking is we'd like to be able to get the roof onto the exhibit sometime next summer if we can come up with the money.
Okay. We just have a minute left or half minute left. Do you have anything else you wanted to add before we wrap it up?
Well, I'd just like to say that we think this will be a major addition to the downtown infrastructure, and we're hoping that it'll encourage people to walk around in the harbor and to enjoy the harbor as a place to go and relax.